Well, you may have heard the terms microbiota and microbiomes. The difference is the microbiota are basically the bugs. So these are mostly bacteria, but there'll also be some fungi and yeast and other microorganisms in there. And the microbiome is actually the genes that are coded, that the genes are all part of these bugs. And what's really important, I think, you know, there's been a lot of simplistic talk about gut bugs in the past as if it's a sort of seesaw of good and bad bugs. And actually, that's not really correct at all. Mostly, of course, there's some outright bad bugs. So if you pick up a pathogen and you get, you know, you get instantly very ill with gastro, that's clearly a bad bug. But actually, it's the balance of all of these different groups of bugs and the diversity of all these bugs in your gut that we know to be important. And that's the overall functioning of the microbiome. So you might have one particular bug and I have a different bug, but they're both doing the same job. And so therefore, it's that overall functioning of the bugs living in our gut that's ultimately important. And why this science is exciting is because they're not just living there, you know, willy-nilly. We've always sort of had this view of bugs as being bad things and we have antimicrobial everything. And in fact, we've learned that we have a very commensal relationship where they benefit from having a place to live and getting food delivered to them. And we benefit from the process that go on with those bugs.
So what do they do? I mean, what is the connection with the brain?
So, well, what's happening is that when we eat some of the foods that we eat, particularly various types of carbohydrates, which are fiber. So fiber is a very loose general term. It covers lots of different compounds, but they're essentially carbohydrates found in plants that we can't break down. And they're prime fuel for lots of those bugs living in our gut. So when those fibers enter the colon is where most of the bugs live. They're fermented by these bugs and it's the byproducts of that fermentation that are ultimately important. So short chain fatty acids, one in particular called butyrate, actually feeds and fuels the cells lining your colon and that keeps them healthy. And then other short-chain fatty acids and other products produced through this fermentation actually are taken up into the bloodstream and act as signaling molecules elsewhere. And then there's this communication between the gut and the brain via these communication or signaling molecules and via the vagus nerve. We get a lot of communication from the gut up to the brain and then some communication from the brain back to the gut. And that's where the link to mental health comes in, which is really pretty fascinating.
Because they're actually producing chemicals that are used by the brain.
They are, absolutely. And some of the research that I uncovered, I mean, working on the Catalyst series was fascinating for me as a nutrition scientist because it really did show the impact of diet. And these researchers that I had the opportunity to interview all around the world were starting to show that perhaps even the dead bacteria that are there act as signaling molecules. So there's all sorts of mechanisms going on there that we're only just starting to uncover and understand. But the bottom line is that we know that that communication happens and we know that we've known for a long time that there's a link between diet and mental health, particularly with things like depression and anxiety. But now we're starting to fill in the gaps of exactly how diet might be influencing brain function and mood. And certainly the microbiome is part of that story.
Okay, and you look at this tonight on Catalyst and you do this through a woman called Victoria who has severe anxiety and gut pains and has had a pretty miserable time over the last couple of years. Let's just have a little listen.
I love my one cup of coffee in the morning. I used to drink lattes until I started to have difficulty with milk. And I noticed more and more that if I was having milk in my coffee, that it was just too, it was making me feel sick in my stomach. I literally could not poop, like at all. And my stomach was out here. And I was horrified. I was like, what is going on here?
Now, she talks there about milk, but I've seen the episode and her diet. Tell us a little bit about Victoria, because her issues were the gut pains, but also the severe anxiety as well.
Well, that's right. And when I first started working with Victoria, and this is a lady she's very, very smart. She has tried absolutely everything and explored for herself and seen lots of different experts over the years. And so, you know, she's a real battler. She's unfortunately, she's not alone. I have now heard from lots of different people across the country sharing similar things. What Victoria struggled with in the early part of us seeing each other was that she's had anxiety since childhood, you know, didn't have the unhappiest of childhoods, has various sort of family issues that had gone on that had resulted in this anxiety. So for her, she didn't have gut problems until into her 40s. So she found the connection between anxiety and her gut difficult to accept in the early years, because she said, well, I've always had anxiety. Why am I suddenly having gut problems? But that's actually also quite a common story. So what we know, the easiest way for me to explain it is to think about, you know, if you're nervous about something, or you're say you've got to give a speech or a big presentation, you get butterflies in your stomach, and then often you'll run to the loo. You know, that's showing us that your hormones and your emotional state affects your gut. Now, for Victoria, it was chronic, and this sort of gut problems built over time. So not only had she had anxiety, but she'd had a lot of antibiotic use during childhood. She had chronic tonsillitis, and so she kept being put on antibiotics. And inevitably, I feel that that's a huge part of the story for her. So I think her gut microbiome had been disturbed right from childhood, got worse over the years, and it's almost as if sort of everything caught up with her by the time she got into her 40s, and then started to experience extreme gut problems. And then unfortunately, because she sort of dealt with her gut issues by taking more and more foods out of her diet, never putting any foods back in again, what happened was when she met me, she really had a very small number of foods that she would eat, and she would eat each food individually. So my whole goal with Victoria, when we measured her gut microbiome, goodness, when I showed Professor Andrew Holmes her results from the measurement of her microbiome, he immediately said, these are gut bugs that are starving. So she literally was not getting the fuel. So it's almost as if the whole situation then spiraled, because her gut bugs were being further affected by the restricted diet. She was then being further affected by gut pain and increasing problems. And so it really had sort of spiraled out of control until she was in a situation that was just impeding her life.
Yeah, and it affected her food choices, as you mentioned, because you see this scene where she's in the supermarket with you and you say, okay, let's try some strawberries. And she couldn't pick out a punnet of strawberries because the anxiety would take over. And she was saying that process could take, you know, half an hour because she would be so fussy about that strawberry.
Yeah, well, what was interesting about Victoria was she was always all very interested in nutrition, and she wanted to eat really, really well. So she was also, you know, fussy about making sure the quality of her food was very good. But, you know, alongside her, because she'd been struggling for so long with these gut issues and experiencing real pain, you know, this is a real problem we're talking about here. We're not, the links to mental health, I have to stress, are not about it being all in the head. You know, she had very real pain and very real gut problems. But then along with that came this anxiety and fear of eating because of the pain. And so then her anxiety also escalated alongside it. So the two were sort of fueling each other. And the way that I tried to explain it to Victoria was a kind of chatter going on between her brain and her gut that never died down. And so it was almost as if her gut was in the same anxious state that her mind was in. And then the two were sort of fueling each other. So it was very, very difficult to get her over the fear of eating, to encourage her towards trying some new foods. It was very, very difficult for us both.
And you did see changes, you know, as you introduced her to these new foods over that 6-7 week period. There were certainly some slow improvements, but definitely improvements. I'm speaking on ABC Radio Perth with Dr. Joanna McMillan. She is a nutrition and lifestyle specialist, a nutrition scientist. Let's bring Charlene Grossi into this conversation. She is an advanced accredited practicing dietitian. And Charlene, listening to what Joanna's been saying, do you see a lot more of these kind of issues with the patients you're dealing with?
Yeah, most definitely. And you find, you know, we know that there is a big link with irritable bowel syndrome with increased anxiety and stress. And, you know, I find it fascinating, as Joanna's alluded to, is our gut microbiome is so vast and diverse. And individually, we have such an array of differences. You know, I've read in one article that they say with our DNA, we're 99.99% as the next person next to us, and we can see that there's such differences. Yet when you start to look at the gut microbiome, there's only 10% that's similar. There's been big projects internationally looking at what is a healthy gut microbiome, and the diversity has just been astounding in looking what it is. Our gut microbiome is influenced greatly from the day we're born, you know, whether we're born naturally or through a cesarean, whether we're formula fed, breastfed, exposure to antibiotics, as Joanna mentioned, and environmental exposures, the type of diet that we've eaten.
And early childhood stresses?
Early childhood stresses, yeah, for sure.
What sort of things?
Well, it depends on family dynamics. So, you know, if someone's grown up in a stressful environment, exposure, you know, if they were bullied in school, some kids are just naturally anxious personalities.
So it doesn't have to be the extreme cases that Joanna mentioned in Victoria's case. You know, Joanna, you were mentioning, you know, she had a very troubled childhood, and that sounded like a very extreme case, but it doesn't have to be.
No, you do notice in young children, you know, some people are naturally anxious, and sometimes they see the patterns of their parents' stress with work and with life and the chaos that goes with it, trying to balance, you know, the whole family and work. So sometimes we naturally pick up on those patterns, but it doesn't have to be an extreme case as in Victoria's situation. So yes, that does occur, but I think we live in a very stressful environment, and sometimes we don't give enough appreciation to how much stress that kids are growing up in today's society.
So what are the most common complaints you see?
So When people are coming to my clinic, and I specialise in gastrointestinal diseases, so I am seeing the part of the population that are suffering with these symptoms, but the main symptoms that you'll find is abdominal pain and discomfort, altered changes to their poo patterns, so whether they're getting diarrhoea, they may be getting constipation, so a change in the consistency of their stools, but also a change in frequency. When they can also have bloating, distension, and even feelings of incomplete emptying when they're passing a stool motion, and sometimes there's urgency associated with it. The symptoms are quite broad, and what I think we need to keep clear is that the symptoms that present with a disorder like irritable bowel syndrome are not exclusive to that syndrome or that disorder. And so it's really important that people seek medical advice to get the correct diagnosis. Other disorders of the gastrointestinal tract, such as celiac disease, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, diverticular disease.
Sure, okay, thanks.
They all need to be excluded first. Those sort of symptoms for women could also be a sign of ovarian disorders. That could be signs of colon disorders, say colon cancer. So it is really important that we get the correct diagnosis. So irritable bowel would be an exclusion diagnosis, that we know that there's no prevalent disease that I've mentioned. And then there's a criterion around abdominal pain and discomfort occurring for at least 3 days a month over a 3 to 6 month period, associated with symptoms of relief upon passing a stool motion, or a change in the frequency or the stool consistency.
And in my daughter's case, it was just pain and bloating.
Yeah.
She just had a stomach ache for a year. So, Joanna, it's a very wide, it's a bit of a fishing exercise, isn't it, when you're looking at these issues?
Well, it is. And just to build on that, I think this is also it's really, really important that people don't self-diagnose. And unfortunately, this is what happens as people have become more aware of IBS. They hear about different diets like the low FODMAP diet. They're doing a Google search and they're applying all these things to themselves instead of, you know, I always say, you know, your first port of call has to be your GP to rule out any medical problems. And then if it is an irritable bowel and you want to, you know, then seeing a dietitian who specializes in that area like Charlene is exactly the right approach, because it's very important that you understand the diet therapies and understand how to implement them properly. So we're seeing a lot of, so one of the groups that I worked with a lot on the show is the Monash group, who developed the low FODMAPs diet, and that's their key concern, that they're seeing lots of misunderstandings and misconceptions about the dietary approach. The second thing that was just going on in my head there is from many of the experts I spoke to, including some of the top gastroenterologists in this country, one of the other key concerns they've got is about what is normal gut function. Now, we have the very overt cases, you know, and I'm sure your daughter sounds as if she was one of those where, you know, there clearly are real issues going on there. But, you know, I also had a GP telling me the other day about the number of children now coming in with abdominal pain, where actually it's constipation related to their diet and their diet not having enough fiber. You know, perhaps mum and dad have been cutting out carbohydrates for weight control, and suddenly they're losing fiber along with the refined carbs that we do want people to cut back on. The gastroenterologists are telling me that they see people who literally just have lost sight of what normal gut function is, and they don't know how often a day you should be farting or going to the bathroom or what should a normal stool consistency be. And so I think, you know, we're in polite society, we don't talk about these things, but actually we have to. We have to sort of start to understand a little bit more about what normal bowel function is and how to improve your diet to make sure that you're supporting good gut health.
Yeah, look, and you know, it's interesting with my my daughter's experience, because I cook everything at home. You know, I think I do. And this is because you do, you look at yourself and go, what am I doing wrong? What am I feeding her wrong? Why suddenly this pain? Why is her stomach so bloated? You know, all my meals are cooked at home. We have, yeah, 5 fruit and veg a day. And I was told her issue may have been from a previous infection. That did leave her in hospital for a week. And so, you know.
And that's a common story.
Yeah. One of our guests just explained, what is IBS? How do you define IBS?
Yes, IBS, as I mentioned before, is a disorder. It's an exclusion process. So it's using what we have called the Rome 3 criterion. So that's the international diagnostic criterion. And it relates to that abdominal pain and discomfort for the 3 to 6 months.
Yeah, and it does manifest in the different ways. It can be the diarrhoea, the constipation,
or the
pain.
So there's the 3 subtypes, the diarrhoea predominant, constipation predominant, and the mix, where people can alternate.
Okay, let's go to Imogen. Hi, Imogen.
Okay, my 7-year-old son is highly anxious and had diarrhea for years, and we exhausted sort of all options, and his gastroenterologist finally diagnosed him with IBS. We tried the FODMAP diet a couple of times, but were told we could only do it for a few weeks at a time because he was so young. The symptoms were alleviated, but not the anxiety. My question is, how do I get his gut microbiome tested? Because apart from getting the diagnosis of IBS, we haven't really been given any solutions long-term to help him with his anxiety.
Well, maybe I'll jump in first just to make some comments about testing the microbiome, and then I'll pass on to Charlene about therapy. The first thing to say about just a word of warning about watching the show, we did a very expensive test to get a measurement of everybody's gut microbiomes, including mine, so that we could understand exactly what was going on. Now, you can have that test done. It's a Brisbane group who are doing it, and amongst others. Be very, very careful about the test that you pay for, though. A stool test where they sort of grow the bugs in the lab that were in the poo is not testing the microbiome. The microbiome is a genetic profiling test. Now, the trouble is, A, it's very, very expensive, and I don't recommend getting it done because at the moment it is not a diagnostic tool. It's a research tool, and until we understand a little bit more about exactly what it's telling us, it can certainly give us a little clues, and we're starting to understand a little bit more, but it's not yet a diagnostic tool. So I'm really not convinced that it would be a good spend of money for you, and it would really tell you anything more to do with your son. So Charlene, did you want to say anything about therapy?
Yeah, sure. So you mentioned that you tried the low FODMAP diet, and just for our listeners who aren't aware of what that is, it's one of the therapies that can be used to help manage symptoms in patients that are presenting with IBS. So it's an acronym that stands for low, and then the F is for fermentable, oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. So it's a very fancy way of saying it's a poorly absorbed sugar that can present and cause gut symptoms. Now, we know from the research, and Monash, as Joanna mentioned, have been leaders in this area, and internationally it's been replicated, that around 3 out of 4 people with IBS will have an improvement in their symptoms, and particularly when it's diarrhea predominant. But then we have the 25% that are non-responders to that particular dietary therapy. So there are other options of dietary therapies that can be considered, but when we're looking at anxiety and stress, there's also very good research that has shown the role of hypnotherapy to be very effective, and that's been done in adults. And then more recently, a study was released looking at the role of yoga. So again, not necessarily applicable to a 7-year-old, but it is important to get the correct advice and the correct help for the specific age of your child. But there are therapies that do replicate. And in the early studies, they used to see the low FODMAP diet being quite effective. And then hypnotherapy was thought to be a bit of an adjunct therapy, whereas now the studies are showing that hypnotherapy can be as effective in some particular people.
All right. Best of luck with that, Imogen. Yep, go on.
Yeah, with
Joanna.
Victoria, we tried. With Victoria, her diet was so limited anyway that I couldn't do low FODMAPs with her. But actually, we tried both yoga and gut-directed hypnotherapy with her, and she found both to be very useful. So you'll find out more about that on the show tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you. And Imogen, best of luck with that one. Let's go to Rodney. Hi, Rodney.
Oh, good morning. Look, interesting program. I just wondered if yogurt is good for you in the mornings. I've noted that, or I've seen a lot of products, liquid yogurts and various other products promote it as being beneficial to the gut. But I'm just wondering if this is just a marketing ploy. And I'm also wondering whether the amazing sugar content in these items is, is a disadvantage if you're taking it, if it is beneficial. Thanks.
Well, actually, there's lots of really great research for not just about gut health, actually, for all sorts of different reasons that natural yogurt in particular is very, very beneficial. You know, there's the protein content, there's particular amino acids that are present that might help with weight control and keeping body fat down. And then it's a fermented food. So there's some live bacteria present in the yogurt itself, depending on the variety that you buy. But there's also the byproducts of that fermentation. So just the same as there's the byproducts of fermentation within the gut are beneficial, potentially in fermented foods like yogurt, but also in kimchi and sauerkraut and these other sort of fermented foods that are increasing in popularity at the moment. There's potentially benefits from these little acids and other things that are produced that give them their traditionally sour taste. So certainly there is some good evidence behind that. Bear in mind with yogurt that the sugar content is the sugars naturally present in the milk itself. Plus, you know, if you have a flavoured yogurt, then there might be there's usually sugar added unless it's an artificial sweetener. And then there's the sugar that's in any fruit. So, I mean, the healthiest yogurt without doubt is to buy an unsweetened natural yogurt, something like a Greek yogurt, and then add your own fresh fruit would be the healthiest choice. But, you know, even the sweetened yogurts, I would still say, you know, there's still benefits to be had from these. But I would, you know, urge you towards the unsweetened varieties.
This text, the link between a dairy and gluten-free diet and autism-like symptoms is interesting. It's been laughed at by a lot of experts, but in desperation, I gave it a shot. Within 1 week, my child was sleeping and meltdowns had decreased in frequency. We have the diagnosis of autism and the diet hasn't cured him, but I really notice a change in his behaviours when he eats off the menu. To our panel, is that something you hear often?
Well, Charlene may deal with this in a practical sense, but if I can just talk the science behind it, be very, very careful with individual case studies. Yep. The science is not there at all. There's been no science to conclusively link any foods actually to autism. But what there certainly are is that kids who have autism definitely have an increased problem with their guts. So they do have problems with specific foods. They often have food intolerances, including intolerances to things like lactose in milk, or to some of the proteins that are present in milk. So while there has been lots of discussion about casein-free and lactose-free diets in autistic children, the results have been very, very mixed from trials, and there really is no solid scientific evidence at the moment. So I would just urge caution to parents of, you know, if something's working for you, then fantastic. Do make sure that your child is getting good sources of calcium from another food if you're cutting out dairy. And, you know, make sure that you see a dietitian if you're concerned about whether you're getting all of the nutrients into his diet.
You, Charlene, wanted to pick up on just that comment regarding gluten.
Yeah, so when we make dietary changes, whether that be gluten-free or dairy-free, for example, when we remove gluten out of our diet, it's not just the gluten that we're changing. So while we may notice an improvement in symptoms or mood, we can't be confident that it's that particular protein that's the cause of those symptoms. That's specific to celiac disease. And newer research is showing that it's actually potentially the fructans, which is the sugar molecule in those grains and cereals that are likely to be improving symptoms of IBS in particular.
I can vouch for that. My daughter is on a low FODMAP diet and it's working wonders. There's quite a few texts coming in regarding the benefits of probiotics. And Jen says, our granddaughter was a very grisly, unhappy child for 10 years. After many, many visits to doctors, she was diagnosed as celiac and lactose intolerant, and she also had learning difficulties. 5 years later, and with careful management, she's much better. My question is, are there any probiotics suitable for her? And as I said, quite a few texts asking about the benefits of probiotics.
Yeah, so a probiotic by definition is a good bacteria that has been shown and demonstrated to have a positive effect on health. So there's two different types of probiotics. You've got those that are naturally found in food sources that were mentioned earlier. So our live cultures in yogurts, the kimchi, kombucha, fermented foods like sauerkraut, etc. So they're naturally found in foods. We don't understand a lot about the way that they interact with the gut microbiome, but we feel from science that there's a positive benefit of including those. And then you've got the probiotics that are on the shelf. And the way I look at those is if we had a condition and we felt unwell, and we told someone we felt unwell and they said, go take a drug or a medication, we would start to break that down and say, well, what medication should I take? What's specific to my condition? How do I know what the side effects will be? What's the evidence? Yet with probiotics, we seem to be quite happy to walk in and just grab one off the shelf. From the science, there's so many thousands and trillions of different bacteria, different strains. It's very strain specific. And often what's shown in research trials isn't available on the shelf or in the correct doses. So in conditions like celiac disease, the best recommendation is to follow a strict gluten-free diet, free of contamination, and that will often resolve the symptoms associated with that condition. If people are interested in taking a probiotic, it's important to speak to a health professional that has the expertise and knows the particular strains for that particular condition, because in some cases it can actually cause negative side effects and that could be counterproductive to that disease management.
Yeah, Joanna, can you elaborate on that and how it does interact with the gut?
Well, I mean, that's what's really interesting. When you look at a probiotic, it usually contains, it might contain only one particular strain of bacteria that's been studied. A lot of the bacteria that are used in probiotics are actually just ones that can be grown in the lab. So the lactobacillus and bifidobacteria are not present in huge quantities really in adults. They're present more in younger children. And they're really just the ones, the bugs that are used to make things like yogurt. So they're easily cultivated in the lab. So what is much more interesting, in fact, are prebiotics, and that's the types of fibres. And interestingly, most of the FODMAPs are also prebiotics, and that's why someone mentioned earlier they were advised not to keep their child on the low FODMAPs diet too long. That applies to adults too. And the reason for that is because we know that a low FODMAP diet over the long term can actually influence and likely will influence the bugs that are living and the balance of the bugs that are living in your gut. So prebiotics, I think, is... And this is what's so exciting about the ability to use diet to influence your gut health and influence your microbiota. And that's probably a much stronger effect than taking a probiotic. So we do have some interesting research on particular strains of bacteria. And I think we will get more targeted and more specific with probiotics. But what we do know now is get more prebiotics into your diet, and then you alter the bugs that are already there in your gut and are specific to you.
So with prebiotics, I'll just explain that they're actually the fertilizer for your own gut bacteria. And so it's very important that we feed our gut bacteria, and the sorts of foods that we find those in are fruits and vegetables, grains, legumes like lentils, chickpeas, kidney beans. And so they'll be, and onion and garlic are quite rich. And as Joanna mentioned, a low FODMAP diet is taking a lot of those prebiotics out. And we know in different conditions, whether that be autism, whether it be in depression, obesity, IBS, that there's different profiles of the gut microbiome that presents. So it's what we call dysbiosis, or an imbalance of bacteria. It's not causal, but we need to be very careful with diet that we're not changing that profile and that balance of bacteria when we could potentially be feeding them and enhancing the good qualities that we require.
And that's why it's important, I guess, and this is where I'm at with my daughter, is the challenge phase where we're actually reintroducing certain foods and then hopefully nut it down to the one or two things. And I've got to say, the only thing she's reacted to so far is onion and garlic. Which for someone from a European background is a nightmare. Yeah. All right, let's go to Susan. Susan, hello.
Hello. Look, I've got a 19-year-old daughter who has had massive anxiety for many years. And at the moment, for a while, she's alternated between constipation and diarrhea. And there doesn't seem to be any middle ground at all. She's just one or the other. Now, she tries the Movicol or those kind of remedies, but nothing seems to work at all. So we've focused mainly on her depression and anxiety, but there's obviously, we need to look at her diet, her gut really. So what would you recommend that we do?
I would recommend seeing an accredited practicing dietitian that has experience in gut health and gastrointestinal disease management. You'll find it's a bit of a vicious cycle. So we have what we call the gut-brain axis and the gut-brain and the brain-gut axis. So it's a cycle. So you'll find just even sometimes knowing that if I eat a food, it's going to make me feel quite unwell, creates anxiety and stress. For some people where they get the urgency and the diarrhea, if they go out socially, it's the stress around where are the toilets and the bathrooms and will I make it in time, can actually exacerbate the symptoms of the IBS as well. So I would suggest finding a dietitian that has experience in that area to help guide you on that journey and to individualise that for your daughter.
Joanna?
Mm.
Yes, absolutely. I completely agree. You know, just as I said earlier, the most important thing to do is to make sure that you have ruled out any medical conditions and then to move on. Working with a dietitian really is, you know, they are the nutrition scientists. They're the experts in diet therapy and working one-on-one with your daughter. And so that is going to be the best help to ensure that, one, you have a diet that provides all of the nutrients that she needs, but also then can explore the various little short-chain carbohydrates that can be problematic in some people.
Thank you for that. Best of luck with that too, Susan. Look, good question here from Dawn. Hi, Dawn.
Oh, good morning. Yes, please. I'd like to know, it hasn't been mentioned, can this IBS be passed on to your children?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I'll start. Charlene can jump in after. One of the things that I found most fascinating in my exploration over the last year into the microbiota in particular is that, in fact, that you inherit initially your microbiota from your mother. So there have been, initially, these are just in rodent studies, but what they show is that actually there's a loss of diversity of the microbiota from generation to generation. And so this is the concern that this may be happening in humans, that because we, you know, when you move from a rural environment where you have much greater exposure, you know, if we look at people who live in a farming community, for example, and my microbiome was indicative of this because I grew up, you know, right next to a farm in Scotland in the country, and my microbiota was much more diverse than the people who had grown up in an urban environment. So then when you move from rural to urban, we have this loss of diversity in part because there are more cesarean births, there's more breastfeeding doesn't go on quite so long. The types of foods used to wean children, and then the lack of fibre diversity in the diet right from childhood up till adulthood is resulting in actually a loss of diversity. So although IBS itself, I haven't seen any evidence, Charlene will comment more on this as to whether that can be passed on, what we certainly see is that there are distinct changes in the microbiota that are passed on from mother to child. And that may well be resulting increasing, and that maybe what is also causing this sort of seeming, you know, exponential rise in gut problems over time.
I would agree, Joanna. You've answered that very thoroughly. And you do see it in practice that there's often a link within families of gastrointestinal discomfort, or they'll remember, you know, my aunt had this or my mum had that. I don't think it's well established in research that it's that black and white. We still don't understand a lot about the causes of IBS, but we do know that there's triggers such as diet, environmental triggers such as diet, stress levels, a change in routine and infections.
Great question, Dawn. Thank you for that. Off the text, Mary, I have been told that I have a slow bowel and really battle with constipation, even though I eat a good diet of fruit, veggies, salads and high fibre and cereal and bread. I drink plenty of water and I take a probiotic daily with 10 billion active cells. And yet Mary still suffers.
Yeah, and see, if you've got a long bowel, that is going to affect motility. So what will be happening is the role of our colon or our large intestine is to help form the stools and the faeces. And the longer that they sit there, the more water that's being taken out and hardening. It would be good to get some individualised advice to see the exact dietary components, what different types of fibres are being consumed, because different fibres have different benefits and different roles. Also looking at which probiotic, because different probiotics will have different benefits. So the type of probiotic may not be the one specific to constipation.
And lots of texts again coming in on probiotics, and the message there is get your advice, get your professional advice, because there are so many different strains and an individual.
The other thing that I'll just add to that is just to look beyond diet. There are actually other things that affect gut motility in particular, but overall gut health. And one of those is activity. You know, we are much, much less active. And when you spend a lot of time sitting, that is not good for gut function. So, you know, one of the things that you'll find if you're getting constipated regularly, then try walking more and getting more activity, breaking up sitting time, because actually when you exercise and you move, that also stimulates your gut to contract and to move.
Okay, a couple of really quick ones. We've got about a minute left. Julia says apple cider vinegar, good or not? Yes or no?
Well, actually, it is a fermented food, but you know, to my mind, there's no conclusive evidence behind apple cider vinegar in particular. Actually, all vinegars tend to be pretty good for gut health. Vinegars are slightly acidic, of course. That's the nature of the vinegar, and that's those little acids, just as the short chain fatty acids produced in fermentation may be beneficial. Those we've known for a long time that things like acetic acid, that's vinegar, are also good for gut health. What I do urge, though, is do not be downing shots of apple cider vinegar. It's very, very harsh on the cells lining your esophagus and in your mouth. It's terrible for your teeth. So, you know, I urge, yes, use vinegars as part of your salad dressing or in foods, because that lowers the GI, actually, of the meal as well. Then there may be benefits for the gut, but don't be downing shots of vinegar.
All right, and I'll just read this final text from Helen. She says, after seeing a doctor re-anxiety and years of bad gut, I simply changed my diet to real food only. I went from bad gut symptoms to good gut symptoms within a couple of days. The result has been a clear head, reduced stress, no abdominal pain and no bloating. It's been a real life changer. Thank you, Helen. Thank you also to Dr. Joanna McMillan, a nutrition scientist and lifestyle specialist. So great chatting to you.